Thank you for tuning in to Voices for Freedom, an anti-human trafficking podcast. We want to acknowledge that the content we discuss can be emotionally challenging and may evoke strong reactions. The stories we share often delve into tough subjects related to human trafficking, which may be difficult for some listeners to hear. Our goal is to raise awareness and promote understanding of the complexities surrounding human trafficking. Listener discretion is advised. Coming up on Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast.
It started in, I think, Australia, where they had identified a young boy who appeared to be Thai, who was wearing a green shirt, being sexually assaulted by, at that time, an unknown male. Thai law enforcement, as well as international law enforcement agencies, had kind of collaborated and identified an offender, but the victim was still unidentified. They knew they needed to somehow communicate with this offender in an undercover capacity to try to manipulate him into revealing who this boy was that they knew he had sexually abused a year or so before. That's why they reached out to us.
And welcome to Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast brought to you by Our Rescue. We are so excited with the launch of this series. We hope that you'll tune in each week to learn about the amazing men and women united in this cause to end child exploitation and human trafficking. In this episode, we have a real treat as we are going to hear from, I'll just be honest, one of my heroes who is on the front line in the vanguard of this fight. And he's coming to us live from Southeast Asia. We're going to call him Alex. Alex is his undercover operator name. I've gotten to know him for quite a while now and just am so impressed with the work he's done. It's very late night his time, so let's go more than halfway around the world. Alex, are you with us? Do you hear us?
I'm with you, Matt. Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
I appreciate it. So throughout this episode, we're going to talk and focus mostly on one of, I would say, the most emblematic and iconic cases that you worked and that we worked here at Our Rescue. But before we start, please give our viewers and our listeners and supporters a little bit of an idea of your background in the U.S. first as a law enforcement officer, and then what really led you to pick up and move to Southeast Asia to really start, in a lot of ways, Our Rescue's office in Thailand. And then, of course, now you can talk about where you're coming from today as you've recently made the move.
Thanks, Matt. So my background prior to joining OUR, I was full-time law enforcement, a little bit over 20 years in the U.S., the last 10 years or so doing mainly focusing on cyber crimes, crimes against children, human trafficking cases. I was heavily involved as an ICAC affiliate. ICAC is Internet Crimes Against Children, working lots of kind of multi-jurisdictional cases with, you know, federal agencies, neighboring agencies, going undercover online, posing as victims, posing as a like-minded offender, seeking out people that were looking to exploit, abuse, you know, and harm children online. I did that for a little over 20 years. And then, you know, as I was getting near the end of my career, there's, you know, still a lot of passion. I love the work.
No doubt. I can tell. I mean, even some of the dirtiest work ever, I could never do it, but I know that you're so committed to this.
Yeah, it's great. And then, you know, I found OUR that, you know, had, I don't know if you remember that first interview, it was a one-year contract. It was a one-year contract. I was going to step away for a while and come out and kind of do some training in Southeast Asia and train some law enforcement. And now it seems like barely a year has gone by, but it's been more than six and I'm still here.
Well, we're so grateful for that. And, you know, you coming on board so many years ago was an indication to those of us in Our Rescue that some of the operations we were doing, while effective, while empowering law enforcement, some of the stings, some of the parties we were doing overseas, were not as effective in terms of really getting those hardened pedophiles, those child predators. But what you had, that expertise with Internet Crimes Against Children on the task force, working in the central United States where there was a lot of trafficking, and then to go overseas.
Well, I'll tell you, it was scary stepping away from a 20-plus year government job. And then kind of going private sector, as you will, was scary. Getting over, once I first got to Thailand, It was, I very quickly learned that the Thai authorities were just as intelligent, just as passionate as any law enforcement agency or officers I've worked with in the U.S. The issue there, as it is in most countries that I've worked in, it's budgetary issues, right? It's money. These are complicated cases. There's you know, extensive technology involved, multi-jurisdictional issues. There's certifications and software and hardware that's needed. So that's what it was about. So it was quick to see that was a gap we could fill, but it's not just that. It's also the training. You know, I was bringing 20 plus years of experience with me over there to work these types of cases.
You know, we've talked in the past about how in the United States, and this is again a generalization, but human trafficking, child exploitation in a lot of ways is drug fueled, drug driven, and oftentimes predators prey on vulnerabilities of, you know, kids who don't have the love that they need from home, you know, mom and dad, you know, broken homes. However, talk to us briefly about what it's like in Southeast Asia with the child sex tourism, with some of the foreign nationals that you were helping Thai authorities target.
Yeah, it's just the same. It's, you know, these offenders are, I've often seen in my cases through the years, are motivated by one of two things, money or some type of a sexual interest in children or some combination of both. A lot of tourists are coming over to many countries in Southeast Asia where there are many local people that are victims of the economy, that are in dire need of any type of assistance they can be. And it does not take long for an experienced offender to zoom in on that and really start grooming, not just grooming children, but grooming their parents to allow access to them. You know, I've seen in the 20 years I've been doing it, and then especially the last 6 years here, I want to say I think I've seen every possible way somebody could be exploited. And just when I start thinking that, you know, something new comes up.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine what you go through and what you see every day. I know a lot of our supporters are wondering how you do your job, how you essentially trick these predators, pedophiles, traffickers, how you gain their confidence. So would you mind talking a little bit about that and perhaps using one of, as I mentioned, the most sort of iconic, emblematic cases? Some of our supporters will know it as the boy in the green shirt. I know you have other op names for it, but maybe if you would walk us through that of how you have the online persona, how you go and find these targets, and perhaps using this case as an example.
Sure. This was an interesting case. This was a international case. It started in, I think, Australia, where they had identified a young boy who appeared to be Thai, who was wearing a green shirt, being sexually assaulted by, at that time, an unknown male. Thai law enforcement, as well as international law enforcement agencies, had kind of collaborated and identified an offender, but the victim was still unidentified. One of the services we offer law enforcement here in Southeast Asia is investigative support. We have a lot of, it's not just creating a fake Facebook page and trying to talk to somebody. There's a lot of work that goes into these types of cases. There's a lot of maintenance on these undercover accounts and these anonymous accounts, and they're not something you can create, you know, very quickly and make them look believable. We have a lot of experience behind us. We have a pretty robust team of investigators that are constantly seasoning those accounts and maintaining those. So when they knew they needed to somehow communicate with this offender in an undercover capacity to try to manipulate him into revealing who this boy was that they knew he had sexually abused a year or so before. That's why they reached out to us.
And again, just to emphasize for listeners, the age of this boy, more or less, what did law enforcement think? What did you think? We're talking about how old?
At the time, about 6 or 7 years old. So one of the things we did is looked at the offender's online footprint. We have remarkable access to law enforcement, multiple countries here in Southeast Asia, work very closely with them. I'm very much aware I'm a retired law enforcement officer. I have no arrest powers, no arrest authority. We work under the supervision and the purview of local law enforcement here. And oftentimes they'll ask us to come in and kind of consult on cases where in areas where they lack. And certainly at that time on online undercover investigations, that they needed some assistance. So we came in, looked at this offender's online footprint, looked at what sites he was on, what social media he used, where he communicated, how he communicated, what he did for a living. And the goal is to somehow integrate into the life of the offender without the offender raising suspicion. Because in this case, it was unique where we already knew an offense had happened. All we needed to do was build trust and rapport with this offender to kind of get him to allow us access to his online life so we could hopefully track down this victim.
Yeah. And a couple things come to mind based on what you said. You know, first and foremost, as you mentioned, we have no arrest authority. And oftentimes, you know, people ask, well, is our rescue, are you guys a vigilante organization? And absolutely not, have never been. We only work with the green light of host country authorities. In this case with, you know, Thailand, now where you are in, you know, Malaysia and Southeast Asia. So that's important. Secondly, talk about access to law enforcement. Now, do you have access to law enforcement databases or information, or is this purely what we call OSINT, open source intelligence and online media profiles? Is that, are you purely doing that, or do you have any access to some of the information that perhaps only law enforcement has?
Yeah, no access to law enforcement databases. So OSINT, open source intel, which is mainly social media, some websites, and just, you know, looking at, you know, each person's online footprint's a little bit different. But just looking at where this person's already present and then looking at ways we can kind of, again, integrate into that life without raising any suspicions and at least get him to trust us and hopefully at some point think we're like-minded and start sharing and bragging about some things that he may have done in the past.
Well, that's an excellent way to tee up then for our next segment. We're going to talk about how you did find information about this suspected predator's likes and how you really went above and beyond to learn about what he liked and to ingratiate yourself with him to gain his trust and move forward. It's a crazy operation, even a few years now past, and I look forward to hearing more about it, and I know that our viewers will as well. So please do not go anywhere. We will be right back with Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast brought to you by Our Rescue. I want to thank today's sponsor, the Our Rescue Store, for supporting this podcast. Did you know the Our Rescue Store features survivor-made items? In this critical fight, they serve as symbols of hope. By choosing to purchase one of these beautifully handcrafted items, you will impact the healing journey of survivors and help them reclaim their lives in the process. We encourage you to shop survivor-made items on the Our Rescue website. It might only be a few dollars to you, but it makes a world of difference to them. And in case you need any extra motivation, use promo code VOICES10 for 10% off your purchase at store.ourrescue.org. That's VOICES10 at store.ourrescue.org. And welcome back to Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast brought to you by Our Rescue. I'm Matt Osborne, Global Ambassador for Operations and Education, and I'm so excited about being able to bring this podcast series to you along with my co-host Jessica Mass, whom you'll see from time to time on these episodes as well. But today we have the privilege of going all the way to Southeast Asia to talk to our undercover operator codenamed Alex. In the first segment, Alex talked to us a little bit about his previous career in the U.S. as an ICAC, Internet Crimes Against Children investigator, undercover, creating online profiles, and then his, I would say, bravery, as I've known him for a while, to take a leap of faith to go over to Southeast Asia and to help build our Thai office for Our Rescue. Alex is talking to us about the famous, infamous case of the boy in the green shirt, how law enforcement agencies provided him, all he had was some photographs, right? Maybe even some videos, something where they knew that a small boy of 5, 6, 7 years old was being sexually abused. And Alex, is it true that law enforcement gave you a probable first name and last name identity? That was all you had to go on along with these images? And then walk us through how you used only open source information, only things that were publicly available of what this suspect was putting out online and other investigation techniques and tactics you were able to use to ingratiate yourself with this individual, find what he liked, and ultimately gain his trust that allowed this investigation to move forward.
Sure. So no details on the victim from law enforcement other than some pretty good facial shots. So we were able to see him very, very, very well. We just no identifiers. We did have first and last name of the offender who had is visible in some of the imagery. Law enforcement was able to identify him through some unique tattoos that were on his hand and other parts of his body. So we were able to, at least we had a starting point of somebody we needed to start with to try to gain access to their life. as we started that, one of the first things we'll do is, you know, we talked about in the first segment, is start looking at their online footprint. What social media are they using? What websites are they using? Where do they work? Where are they living? Just basic stuff that you can learn from somebody that's, or by monitoring somebody's social media account. Once we got his first and last name, it didn't take long to find social media and then just kind of zero in on him after that.
You know, one thing just real quick, and sorry to interrupt, but it's just fascinating because I hear sort of a contrast in what you're saying. The perpetrator, suspected perpetrator at this point, appeared to take pains to hide his identity, correct, in terms of his face and obviously the tattoo. So he was hiding that, and yet it was amazing, wasn't it, how much wittingly or unwittingly he was putting out online, which is a good reminder for all of us, correct, on our social media, everything we put out, that nothing is secret and that someone could find out information about us.
You just said it. I mean, so, you know, we're a culture of overshares now. It's just so much data that's out there. And, you know, that's what I do for a living is I look at people. I look at what they put online. I build profiles and look at ways of using that information to protect children. And it's one of our greatest resources, social media and online content.
And it didn't take you long then to find out, essentially, as you said, with his first and last name, to go, what were some of the things you were able to find out about this individual, pattern of life, interests, likes, and dislikes?
Yeah, all of it. Pattern of life, likes, dislikes, is very clear about sexual orientation, which matched up with the gender of the victim. And then we noticed that the offender was appeared to be a very talented cartoonist. He did a lot of anime cartoons, would often post photos of drawings and things that he made, and it was very high quality, and was actually offering lessons to people that were interested in taking lessons from him, learning to draw anime and learning to draw cartoons, which I'm sure you're seeing where I'm going with that. That's obviously a way to kind of integrate into his life and gain face-to-face access outside of social media.
Did you have any previous experience with anime, cartoons, anything like that?
Now, you know, I spent a few hours in detention for doodling in class, and but that's about it. You know, nothing professionally, and but you know, it's easy. It's not whether it's guitar or learning to draw or play the violin. It's just being comfortable talking to people, talking to them, and being in their presence in a way that doesn't erase suspicion and calms them. It's all about just building trust and building rapport where they feel comfortable enough to start opening up their lives where we can get access to more data.
Right. Did it seem like this was his main source of income, these cartoon classes, or did he have other jobs that you could tell?
It did. It seemed like it was his main source. He did. He had a small street food stall that he used every now and again. He cooked dinner for me one night. After eating that, I can't imagine that that was much of his income because he wasn't that great at it. He was a much better cartoonist than he was a cook.
I can imagine some of our viewers right now saying, wait a sec, you broke bread with the devil, which is what we have to do. And so I'm fascinated. How did you gain his trust? Did he not suspect or did he have other Western clients for his classes? Any Western students?
I think it was his first, actually. And we kind of went over that to see if that was an issue, but we decided, you know, it's a culture. Southeast Asia is heavily visited by tourists, millions of tourists all over this area. So it's not uncommon for tourists to interact with locals. Didn't raise any suspicions at all. I, you know, in the persona that we custom built for this operation, I made him believe I had a younger son that was in the U.S. that I was going to be bringing over soon. And I wanted to kind of learn how to draw to surprise my son when he came over. And then when my son arrived, maybe all of us could do drawing lessons together. So we kind of, you know, I hate to sound insensitive, but dangled the carrot there a little bit because, you know, we understand what motivates these offenders. Yeah. And, but that gained us access to him outside of social media. Now I'm sitting on the floor in his living room. I'm not sitting behind the keyboard looking at his Facebook posts or his Instagram posts. Now we're sitting across from him and now we can do some work.
Yeah. Well, I know the answer to this just because I've known you for a few years and know your inner fortitude, but how did you keep yourself from not just coming across the floor and strangling this guy and beating the snot out of him, right? How did you keep it together? And then how did you slowly but surely build then the evidence, the case that allowed Thai authorities to give the green light to move in for the arrest?
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough to sit there sitting behind a keyboard talking to somebody, pretending to be somebody that I'm truly not. But it's much different when you're sitting there face to face. You know, I don't know how I deal with it. I just, my eye is kind of on the future. I know that at some point we're going to be in court and I'm going to hear the gavel and I'm going to see that victim or not, excuse me, that offender crying or upset because he's getting sentenced to prison for the rest of his life. That's what I focus on in those moments. I'm mad. I'd love to, you know, physically assault him. I'm just, you know, we're not going to do it. It's too important to the investigation. We don't just want to rescue victims. We don't want to just assist and intervene and stop the abuse. We want to make sure the offender is in a position to never abuse another child victim again. So I kind of use that.
How then finally take us through the final green light, the arrest, if I'm remembering correctly, was there a sort of a last meal kind of thing, a little poetic justice for this person? I knew he likes a certain restaurant and you set it up that he was going to eat there and talk us through that.
So I took lessons from him for a couple months and, you know, not every day, once a week or, you know, different places, various places. And sometimes at his private residence, other times at public parks, you know, it's an active in criminal investigation. So I don't want, you know, viewers to think I'm out there alone doing this. We, you know, we have law enforcement support, we have surveillance teams, we have security teams, top cover, all that's there. But we often met in restaurants and he always wanted to meet in Burger King. He loved Burger King. He was a big Whopper fan. So I always purposely would do Starbucks, we'd do McDonald's, we'd do KFC, we never did Burger King. But anyway, I took lessons from this guy for a couple months, finally, you know, built enough trust and rapport where he finally added me on his social media. I got access where we could communicate online. I prefer, it's good to meet somebody face to face and talk to them face to face. It reassures them. You can build trust and rapport there, but it's also better once that rapport is built, when I can go back and we can communicate online, because it's kind of a mask, right? Give a man a mask and he'll show you his true self. So there's a little bit of hiding behind that keyboard. So once we've built trust and rapport, I'm still communicating with him online and I start dropping hints that I'm interested in kind of the same things that he is. I'm asking about some young kids that I see around his area, and he quickly associates me as a like-minded offender, provides me access to all of his social media, tells me about other victims that he sexually assaulted that were not the boy in the green shirt.
He's speaking openly with you at this point. He doesn't fear anything. So you've totally convinced him, pulled the wool over his eyes.
Right. And then he never would give up the boy in the green shirt. He just wouldn't talk about it. He was talking about other victims that he was currently in contact with. But he did finally allow unrestricted access to his social media. So I got friends lists, everything. He lifted all of his security restrictions. I was able to view everything. Our OSINT team was actively looking at everything. And after a several month exhausting event of looking at his social media, friends of friends of friends, we were finally able to identify the boy in the green shirt, that they no longer had a relationship. He was no longer friends with him via social media and other online content, but we were able to find him through friends of a friend. And I'll never forget that day. It was 4 or 5 months of all of our lives just looking for the boy in the green shirt. I would be sitting on the train. I would look over. I'd see kids in green shirts. And I'm just wondering, where is this kid in the green shirt? And we finally found him.
And was the actual takedown at a Burger King? What was it? And what was his reaction? And did he ever know that it was you who ultimately betrayed him, so to speak?
He finally figured it out. And absolutely, I knew we were going to arrest him. Law enforcement had asked us to set up one more art lesson. They were going to arrest him, serve a search warrant, actual multiple search warrants that day. So I knew he was going to jail. So just being who I am, I set it up at Burger King. We had it timed out perfectly. He arrived. We ordered, went and sat back down. He'd ordered his Whopper. He knew it was coming. He could smell it. He could taste it. And law enforcement walked up to him and hooked him up and took him away, and he never got it. And I think he'll get one. I mean, if he makes it, he'll get one. He's got just a short 55 years to serve in a Thai prison. And then then Burger King's all his.
A little poetic justice. Well, that's good. Well, I do want to hear more about the sentence, more about the follow-on arrests and rescues and others. So let's take a quick break now, and we'll come back for the third segment with undercover operator Alex. Don't go anywhere. You won't want to miss the final segment of Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast brought to you by Our Rescue. A big thanks to our sponsor, Our Rescue Store, for supporting our podcast. The Our Rescue Store is committed to responsibly sourcing products that ignite conversations about human trafficking, raising awareness, and contributing to the movement against it. With more than enough colors, designs, and items to choose from, there is definitely something for you. Find something you'll be proud to own and be an advocate for change. Visit store.ourrescue.org and use the promo code VOICES10 for 10% off your purchase. That's Voices10 on store.ourrescue.org. And welcome back to Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast brought to you by Our Rescue. If you're just joining us, you've missed a lot. We are talking with undercover operator codenamed Alex, coming to us live late at night his time in Southeast Asia, talking about the iconic case of the boy in the green shirt and the suspect who was, as you heard at the end of the last segment, ultimately arrested and is now facing 55 years in prison. That's where he is serving, thanks to the work of Alex and the amazing Thai law enforcement and other authorities. Alex, as we move through this final segment, talk to us again about the sentence we heard of, the conviction, but I heard that law enforcement also served search warrants on the Nene Modeling Agency because this suspect, now we can call him this predator, had connections there. Tell us about the results of the operation, both in additional arrest warrants, arrests, convictions, if there were any, rescues, just to show that through this operation, there was so much good that came from it and so much good that continues to happen across the region.
Yeah, so exactly that. This offender that was arrested, that we just were speaking about, me, was an associate of a child modeling agency, the Nene Modeling Agency. That was kind of uncovered through the course of the investigation over those several months. When the offender that I'd been taking lessons from was arrested at the same time his house was being searched by Thai law enforcement, as was the Nene Modeling Agency. There was serving a search warrant there, seizing videos, cameras, micro SD cards.
Of children, adults, boys, girls, everything?
So it was his modeling agency was mainly focused on children. He did have adult clients, but it was, I think, one of the top two child modeling agencies in the country at the time. And this offender that we've been talking about on this segment was a close friend with the owner of the Nene Modeling Agency and was kind of instrumental in finding victims, connecting them with the modeling agency, and then grooming those children. Grooming their parents to allow them to have extended time away from the parents, unsupervised, with members of the modeling agency, which was later determined to be a front for a CSAM distribution network.
Can you give us an idea in terms of amounts of, and again, I'm speaking way over my head here, terabytes of data of you know, videos, footage, how many images? Because again, from my understanding, this is one of the largest seizures, of course, that I've ever heard of, and I think in a lot of ways in the region had ever experienced, correct?
Yeah, it was big. I don't remember the number of devices that were seized, but again, it's a modeling agency. Phones, computers, hard drives, external hard drives, lots of terabytes, lots of cloud storage where things had to be downloaded and pulled from the cloud. I think we looked at over Thai law enforcement. We consult and assist with them in the victim ID phase of identifying some of the victims that are seen in the CSAM, somewhere over 2 million separate files. That's a lot.
And then just to show the geographical reach, we had talked about Bangkok. We talked about the capital city. I understand that the follow-on investigation actually extended even to the north of the country, correct? And maybe even to a teacher. When you think about, we put our trust in these teachers, both in the United States and around the world, and yet we know that sometimes these individuals use their contact and their jobs to get them close to children to do bad things.
We were able to seize some membership lists of members that were active in that CSAM distribution, which I think was in 35 different countries. We're still going through that, making arrests. And then specifically to what you're speaking about, Matt, led us to an offender in Northern Thailand that, again, was a teacher. We were able to uncover some videos of an unknown male, again, sexually assaulting some young boys. And through the use of our private digital forensics lab, and then with using some of the equipment that we have provided to Thai law enforcement, software, digital forensic software, digital forensic hardware that allows them to kind of exploit digital media and pull every last strand of evidence from it, we're able to tie that to a specific location, which led to a school and then to a teacher who was later arrested.
Man, well, you talk about the equipment, and in a few minutes we'll wrap up this episode talking about why the need for this equipment has never been greater, and hopefully those in our audience will be willing to support. But just a couple questions to wrap this up. One is, are investigations still occurring today? I mean, that's the thing. This happened a few years ago, right? 2020, I think, and into 2021. My understanding is that our rescue analysts continue to build new cases, right? Working with local Thai, new cases on local Thai offenders based on some of this evidence found on the Nene Modeling Agency hard drives.
And not just in Thailand, other countries as well. Yeah, we had active offenders that were, this was one of those networks where if you were a member of the network and you were a member in good standing, it was only because you were an active member. That means you provided new content, not just downloaded content, but private content. So a lot of separate reports related to other victims in other countries have been disseminated, which have resulted, you know, in follow-up investigations. Not just in Thailand. And that's very common in all of our cases. I think that's one of the things, it's one of the spaces NGOs can fill internationally, where international law enforcement in general, a lot of times they don't have the time after the arrest to kind of drill down and look at all that data. 2 million separate files, that takes time to go through. You know, we fill that gap where they can move on to other investigations. And you know, if their laws in that country are permissible and we're allowed to consult and assist, you know, we can spend the time and go through there and make those connections for them.
Yeah, and I love when you talk about that too at our rescue. I mean, we've never been involved or supported the defund the police movement either here in the United States or around the world. We fund the police. We're filling gaps in this, and you see why this case is so important. Probably the most important question about this case is, what happened to the boy in the green shirt? Did you ever get to meet him? Do you know what type of aftercare and survivor support was provided to him and the other children, child victims and survivors that you and our Thai law enforcement partners were able to find through this, the resolution of this case?
Once he was identified, immediately he was contacted by law enforcement. His family was contacted by law enforcement. And then identified as a victim very quickly. I didn't get a chance to meet him. I was in the same building on one of the day he was first interviewed. They did a child forensic interview, which is very non-intrusive, very professional way to interview child victims. Thai law enforcement have adopted that principle. It's kind of a Western principle, but it's becoming very popular. I saw him enter the building that day. So I finally got to see him. All I had, you know, up to that point were 6 or 7 photos of him. So it was great to get a new visual mental picture of him, you know, smiling and walking in with his family and seeing him come in. You know, it's still a tough process for a victim to go through, but lots of support from OUR, from, you know, multiple ministries in the Thai government and Thai law enforcement, with social workers and attorneys. That's one of my favorite things about our organization is our aftercare doesn't stop after the arrest. Our contact with victims doesn't stop after the arrest. You know, he was 6 or 7 at the time we found him, and he'll be able to contact any member of our team, especially our aftercare team, you know, from here on out. And we do stay in regular contact with the victims, you know, providing them transportation and hotels when they're traveling for court, medical examinations and mental health issues. So it's very extensive. It's one of my favorite things about the organization.
Yeah. And again, thanks to you and to Damien and so many others who helped build our Thai office into the gold standard it is, and our amazing Thai colleagues. And we have you know, you probably know better than I do, but, you know, upwards of 25, 30 or more Thai nationals working in our office, and you have experts in investigations and social work and digital forensics and this vital aftercare program you talk about, the child forensic interview rooms and in our office. And thank you now for being willing to help in other countries, neighboring countries in the region. We're trying as this we transition now to our rescue as we rebrand and continue to build on the good work we've done in the past. It's going to be exciting to see if we can build sort of on this gold standard in Thai offices along the lines of the Thai office in other countries. But Alex, let's wrap up over the next couple of minutes talking about where it really comes down to now, because this isn't hyperbole, this isn't over-dramatization, but there are so many other boys in the green shirt, right? And other girls out there, child victims, adult victims, and we need to help law enforcement find them. This individual here, I think his name was Me. There are other Me's out there who are exploiting our children. So what would you say, Alex, is the greatest need now? Let's just start right now in Southeast Asia. You mentioned earlier the amazing results that were found in this investigation because of the digital forensics equipment and other things that our rescue was able to provide. What are the greatest needs? If someone listening saying, well, even though I might only be able to get $5 a month or $25 a month, it all adds up. What would this money go to help our partners rescue even more children and, you know, child and adult victims of exploitation and human trafficking?
Yeah, you said it. Every single penny counts. Every single penny counts. These are expensive cases. And it goes towards the proper tools to work the cases. We have, myself, we have, you know, a really wonderful team in Thailand and neighboring countries. Our team, we like to think of ourselves as subject matter experts. We come from relevant fields. We've worked these cases for years. We're aware of the industry standard type software and hardware that's necessary. If you're going to build a team and you're tasked with anti-trafficking, anti-exploitation, there's certain things you need. And that's where we direct that money. We direct it to training so that law enforcement officers properly know how to use the equipment. We, even though we're non-law enforcement, we kind of remain at a law enforcement standard, which is certified software, licensed investigators, we like to keep everything at a law enforcement standard, which is licensed software and certified analysts and investigators using that software.
You know, we always say that we don't just give someone to fish, we teach them to fish. And so not only do we give this equipment, but we teach them. We have experts like you and others. But just to give an idea, what would some of this equipment cost? And again, I don't want the figure to dissuade people from giving $5 a month, $25 a month, because you just said it, every penny counts. But just an idea of why these host governments overseas oftentimes don't have the funding for this vital equipment that some in U.S. law enforcement take for granted.
Right. It's expensive. You're looking at for just processing cell phones, which is a must have. If you're a law enforcement agency and you're working any type of case, you have to process cell phones. When we're talking about cases like child exploitation, where it's multimedia driven, it's probably the number one thing that we process. You know, you're looking at just to be able to process phones properly, 8 to 10,000 just to purchase a unit. That's the hardware. Then you're looking at between 5 to 8,000 per year on the license, just to keep it up with all the updates and software updates that are necessary to properly extract data from cell phone devices. So it's expensive. And then on top of that, there's you know, traditional hard drives that are in laptops and desktops and gaming machines. Same thing. That, you know, that software is 5,000-6,000 per piece of software, and then at least 4,000-5,000 per year to run those.
In each year, and you need it to update.
And then it's a couple $1,000 to train each officer to get certified where they're properly, they understand how the software works, they're able to testify in court, and all that's admissible. We're able to get that bad guy locked up.
And yet, thanks to the generosity of donors to our rescue, we have been able to bring the funds in to provide such a great deal of support in terms of equipment and training to our Southeast Asia partners. But the need is greater than ever, and we need to to do this across the world. I'm going to go off script with one final question for you, Alex, and I've known you for a while. And, you know, to the extent that I was back in the day leading international operations, it was tough, it was gut-wrenching, but I never had to see what you have seen and continue to see these type of images. I'm sure supporters want to know, how do you keep yourself mentally healthy? How do you protect yourself from just this evil? How do you compartmentalize so that this doesn't do what I'm sure it would do to me, lead me to just go home and be in a fetal position all day and never live my life? And yet knowing you, you're happy, you're healthy. Yes, it's horrible what you do each day, but you know you're doing it for a cause. But how do you do this? I can't even imagine, Alex.
Well, I'm part of a great team. So I have a lot of great people that surround me. I've been doing it a long time, and you know, at times it still does bother you, and there's good days and there's bad days. But again, it's small victories for me. It's stopping, even if it's just stopping the abuse of one child in my next case, you know, I'll ride that way for as long as I can. You know, looking at the content now, it's just pixels now. There's certain things now when I'm looking at a digital photograph, I'm interested in, can I extract the make and model of the camera device or the phone device that took the photo? Is there GPS embedded in there? Are there things I can pull? What are those electrical outlets in the back? Are those US plugs or European plugs or those Australia plugs? You know, it's just, I keep my mind busy, focusing on things that are relevant to the investigation that inevitably can lead to the identity of a victim and put a bad guy in jail.
Yeah. And again, one thing you talked about at the outset of this episode, we're talking about the investigation. I can't even imagine the horrible things that were on the image and images you were looking at. But what were you keyed on? A tattoo on a hand, right? On an arm. And then from there, you see what that led to.
This, you know, there's so many small things in each case, but this case, it came down to that tattoo, and it came down to a small metal latch on a window that was in one of the bedrooms at the Nene Modeling Agency that we didn't know about till the very end. Those two small things that so easily could have been overlooked saved a lot of kids.
Well, just incredible. Well, thank you for your work on the case. I know you've got some others in the hopper that we're not yet able to talk about as the legal process moves forward, but we definitely want to have you on a future episode of Voices for Freedom. Alex, thank you so much for staying up late, and thank you for all you do to support our rescue. Please stay safe over there, my friend.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
You bet. And thank you very much for tuning in to this episode of Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast brought to you by Our Rescue. We're so grateful to Alex, to his colleagues, the men and women of Our Rescue in the United States and around the world doing so much to fight child exploitation and human trafficking. We're excited to kick this podcast series off. We're going to have incredible episodes. Please do tune in each week. Thank you so much. As always, please continue to do all you can to support Our Rescue. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Did you enjoy this episode? If so, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have ideas for future episodes, email us at voicesforfreedom@ourrescue.org. Lastly, we encourage you to join the fight. Make a difference today by donating at ourrescue.org or text podcast to 855-944-5646. Again, that number is 855-944-5646.
On the next episode of Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast, join me as I have the privilege to interview the new CEO of Our Rescue, Tammy Lee. You won't want to miss hearing about the future of this amazing organization. Join us on Voices for Freedom.